Welcome back, dear listeners. It's great to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are humbly in your presence talking about the conversations and the dialogues of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam, the ninth divinely appointed Imam from the household of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. So, dear friends, we find that from days gone past and even in the present day, friends and brothers in religion are something that is an idea and a concept that has been around forever. Of course, different statements about friendship, different statements about brotherhood can be found in different religions, but the religion of Islam has really put forth a beautiful concept of friendship and a beautiful concept of brotherhood that can very easily be said is not found in the other religions or of the world, whether Abrahamic or non-Abrahamic religions. A concept of brotherhood which shows equality, or friendship which shows sincerity and honesty, and everything revolves around the pivot of gaining nearness to the Almighty Allah. Of course, we have heard the statement of birds of a feather flock together, or for example, one bad apple will make the whole bushel go bad. And even in the traditions that, for example, an individual will take on the color of their friend, meaning the characteristics and the qualities and the attributes of their friends. And of course, in Islam, friendship and brotherhood being something so integral to the faith, where in the city of Medina, one of the first things that the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam did was to create a bond of friendship between the Ansar, who were the people who of Medina who helped the Muslims, and the Muhajir, the Muslims who had migrated from the city of Mecca. And it's interesting, if we find these bonds of friendship, we will find that the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him, made these bonds either between the old and the young, or the strong and the weak, or the rich and wealthy and the poor, the Arab and the non-Arab, in this manner showing that friendship and equality is something that is not only important in Islam, but it is one of the pivotal aspects of Islam where all Muslims are the brothers of one another. And so here in this conversation, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam very eloquently and very beautifully says that he who has a brother, a friend in the way of Allah, will have a house in paradise. Can it be emphasized any more than this, that we should have brothers in the way of Allah, we should have friendship in the way of Allah, it should be for the sake of Allah, and this brotherhood and this friendship should be in order to strengthen ourselves on the path towards the nearness of Allah. And it is this kind of friendship and this kind of brotherhood that helps us to attain the nearness of the Almighty Allah, which will give us a house in paradise. And what could be a better reward than that for brotherhood and friendship in the way of Allah? This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
From our Imams, the ninth Imam is the first, whose Imamat began at a very young age, about 8 or 9 years old. And this is where we have to realize that when we talk about Imamat, which is the concept of leadership based on divine selection, in that case, age of the leader doesn't really become a factor. When you are talking about the leaders appointed by the people, there you look at their qualifications, their knowledge, their experience, their expertise. But when it comes to the leadership selected by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, Allah sends them equipped with the qualities of leadership. Their source of knowledge is not from a school. They have never seen a tutor. Whatever they have is from the divine sources. And this is, as I even mentioned last week, that when you look at the history of our imams, this is the amazing thing, that the enemies have tried their best to degrade the imams. But no one has come forward to say that this imam was taught by so-and-so. Or when he was young, he didn't know the alphabets, didn't know the Arabic language, and his father employed so-and-so to teach him how to read and write. There is absolutely nothing of that kind. Especially when we look at the ninth imam, you know, there were people in the court of Ma'mun al-Rashid, when he announced that I would like to make him my son-in-law, there were people who challenged that decision. And people like Yahya bin Aksam even were employed to test the imam. Whoever tried to do that to our ninth imam, they faced total humiliation at the end. They realized that, yes, he's very young, but his knowledge doesn't come from people. And when it doesn't come from people, it comes from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. You know, you are not really on the same level to challenge and test them as far as their ilm and knowledge is concerned.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Bringing charm to the Iranian capital with some of the most beautiful Persian orchestra pieces and musical performances to jam-packed concert halls in Tehran, the most prestigious musical event in Iran is underway. The 38th Fajr International Music Festival opened in Tehran on February the 17th. While the capital is hosting over 30 music bands from across the country, foreign musicians have also found the opportunity to go on stage, including these Hungarian musicians. 7 concert halls in Tehran, as well as over 30 other arenas in 14 provinces, are hosting this year's event.
I am grateful to the musicians that took part in the festival this year. I would also like to take the opportunity to tell you that we have added some awards to our list, and other than the Barbat Prize for the Best Music Album, as of this year, we will also have the Best Song, Lyrics and Media Awards.
Over 2,000 musicians are taking part, either in the competitive Barbat Prize section or the non-competitive pop, traditional, and orchestral music sections. What has made this year's event even more special is the performance of the Iranian Police Force Music Band.
It was an honor to perform in the Fajr Music Festival, and I'm glad that military bands now also have a place in this prestigious event. I hope that more bands take part in the future.
But still, as always, the traditional and folk music sections are under the spotlight, adding glitz and glamour to the name Fajr, which means dawn in Farsi and refers to a 10-day period that led to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. This has been the reason to hold cultural events, including a theater, a film, and a music festival, going by the same name every year.
Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
The German city of Munich hosts a security conference every year to discuss global security challenges. The conference this year has been held against the backdrop of the Ukraine war. Berlin, one of Kiev's biggest arms suppliers, barred Moscow from the event. Also excluded from the list of invitees was Iran. In defiance of international norms, three notorious anti-Iran propagandists were invited. The three anti-Iran figures claim that they have achieved unity, along with several others, to campaign for international support in favor of what they call Iran's protest movement. They attended a meeting on the sidelines of the Munich Security Conference on Saturday. During the meeting, Reza Pahlavi, whose family name is synonymous with decades of oppression against the Iranian nation, pleaded with Western countries to work with what he called a different Iran. He said in this case, the West would have, in his words, a true ally. How can the son of deposed Mohammad Reza Pahlavi have forgotten how Iranian people toppled his father's U.S.-backed dynasty in favor of independence and freedom? While Iranians stood up against the monarchy in Iran some 40 years ago and succeeded in overthrowing it, Reza Pahlavi has refused to distance himself from what his father stood for. He likes being named as the son of Shah or Shahzadeh, which shows he has nothing to present rather than his infamous family background. Another anti-Iran figure who attended the meeting was Masih Alinejad, variously promoted as a journalist, activist, and dissident by Western media. Cashing in on the recent riots in Iran, she claimed that Iranians want regime change. Alinejad, who has been on U.S. government payroll for years, also urged the West to take strong action against the Islamic Republic. It's no surprise that a person funded by Washington has pinned all her hopes on Western powers. Since the riots broke out in Iran following the death of a young woman called Mahsa Amini in September, Alinejad has been lobbying for support from Washington and its allies. She has tried to depict the Islamic Republic as an establishment on the decline, citing those weeks of unrest. The riots, however, have since died down and Iran has managed to restore calm. Now it seems that even hardline leaders in the West are not buying into her claims. The three anti-Iran campaigners have also asked the West to exert maximum pressure on Iran and made no secret of their request. They should be reminded that the country has managed to neutralize the effects of Western sanctions and plots. Meanwhile, Iran has been forging strong bonds with multiple countries and become a member of significant cooperation organizations. Excluding Iran from international summits seemed to be in line with desperate efforts by the West to counter the country's growing regional and international power and influence. The participation of millions of Iranians in the 44th anniversary of the victory of Islamic Revolution is an indicator that foreign-backed elements have failed to achieve their goals.
Another scene of wide-scale destruction in Syria, this time signed by Israel. Israeli fighter jets attacked multiple residential targets in Damascus, killing at least 5 people and injuring 15 others, with the majority being civilians.
All residents were sleeping in the building. This is a residential neighborhood. The missile landed here. A number of residents were killed and others injured. There are no officials or any prominent figures living here, only ordinary civilians. All apartments were heavily affected.
At 12:15 a.m., we heard loud noises. I asked my mother to step back from the windows. Suddenly, the house shook and we felt an explosion. All windows broke. We asked for help. This is a tragic reality.
The aggression caused significant damage to private property in the heavily populated Kfar Susa quarter in Damascus. Apartments, balconies, and walls collapsed, and nearby cars were affected. Syria's ancient citadel in Old Damascus was also hit. Analysts say Israel's intention for these attacks is to keep Syria in a state of instability.
For 10 years, Israel has been adopting the strategy of strategic battles between wars. The aim is to eliminate any chance of a war on Israel through weakening the enemy. Israel wants Syria to stay in a state of war and instability. This aggression in particular comes as more countries are planning to restore relations with Syria, something Israel wants to foil.
Syria's foreign ministry sent a letter to the UN saying the strikes are part of Israel's systematic aggression against civilians, urging punishment for the crimes committed by the regime. The ministry called for necessary measures to end such aggressions, as well as a clear condemnation from the United Nations Security Council. One shock after another. This is how Syrians live every day, not knowing whether they'll be waking up to an earthquake, act of aggression, or a terrorist attack. All they ask is for the international community to wake up and help ease their unprecedented plights. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The Rome-based Islamic Center Imam Mahdi has recently published a book on the late Iranian commander, Lieutenant General Qassem Soleimani. Titled A God's Fighter, the Italian-language book revolves around General Soleimani's endeavors to defend the oppressed people. A man, quote, driven by an unshakable faith in God. The book is a collection of messages, thoughts, and letters by General Soleimani, a project that has been supported by all the members of the Imam Mahdi Center.
Who did General Soleimani fight for? By publishing this book, we wanted to shed a light on a man who was always described as an anti-something. Yes, he was against Zionism, he fought against Daesh, but he did all that for God, and that's why we call him a God's fighter in our book. This project intends to fill a void in Italy, as for far too long, all accounts on General Soleimani have distorted his true image.
In 2020, 40 days after U.S. assassination of Major General Qassem Soleimani, hundreds of his posters were hung across many Italian cities. Initiatives to honor the slain Iranian military officer were held in Rome and Milan.
Imam Mahdi Center's book on Soleimani also contains speeches by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, and Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani on General Soleimani's martyrdom. The publication also contains photos portraying Iran's former top military commander.
Finding good quality photos of Soleimani was a daunting task. There are only a few good shots of him around. He was not a poser. He was a humble man and he didn't love to be in the spotlight. My favorite photos are the ones depicting General Soleimani with kids and also his mother.
General Qassem Soleimani, similar to my father, because he caused that I love Islam more and more. He is my hero because he always helped the weak country or weak Islamic country. I'm proud of him.
The book closes with 20 short stories on the life of General Soleimani, his relationship with his family, and with the late Iraqi anti-terror commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Max Civili, Rome.
I am visiting a children's hospital in Kabul, which is said to be overwhelmed with malnourished kids. Every few hours, a sick child is brought into the malnourishment ward, while doctors and nurses are racing against time to save the youngest victims of Afghanistan's crisis.
Unfortunately, this year, undernourished cases, especially severe acute malnutrition, have significantly surged compared to last year. Constant hunger and poverty and differing diseases are to blame for this, which puts us in dire need of more supplies and medical aid.
As you know, Afghans are gripped with poverty and economic problems. As a result, we are overwhelmed with a huge number of malnutrition. We are running out of beds and sometimes we are forced to reject new entries. Besides, childhood wasting as well as child mortality have also soared.
The World Health Organization says in 2023, around 17,000 Afghan babies and mothers are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition, while over 2.3 million children may suffer from moderate acute malnutrition. The UN body adds that an estimated 28.3 million people, which comprises two-thirds of Afghanistan's population, need urgent relief assistance.
We are a family of 10. My husband is a shoemaker. This malnourished child of mine is 3 months old. Two of my children died as a result of wasting and stunting.
Afghan people's miseries are growing day by day. Unemployment, poverty, and famine have gripped the society, with poor and middle-class households being hit hard. Many have brought their malnourished kids here, and I think it is because they have no food in their houses. We are calling on the global community not to ignore Afghans amid political and economic crises.
Concerns are on the rise among Afghans over their isolation from the international community and major cuts in global aid following the Taliban's takeover and U.S. withdrawal from their country.
Afghanistan has one of the highest rates of malnutrition in the world. Afghans are calling on the global community not to leave them alone amid poverty and hunger. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Thursday, Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah warned the United States and its allies that its attempts to stir chaos in the country will not be fruitful.
I'll tell the U.S., if you create chaos in Lebanon, then you will witness chaos in the entire region. If you target our people with your conspiracies, then we will use our power and arms to make you feel pain, even if this means war against your beloved Israel.
The leader of the resistance group also said that the 2019 protests in Lebanon were merely part of a U.S. ploy, which took advantage of weaknesses in the country as part of a new strategy after the failure of direct military invasions.
Lebanon has, from the year 2019, been the target of a new U.S. plot. First, it's a plot to eradicate the achievements and the victories of the resistance and its martyrs. And second, it's a plot to take Lebanon back to being under the hegemony of the U.S., which wants to impose its conditions on the country's domestic affairs and its conditions on relations with the enemy.
Nasrallah, who addressed people during the memorial ceremony of three of Hezbollah's martyred leaders, also emphasized that supporters of the resistance group who are suffering from economic crisis will continue to support the group. Observers believe that all stalemates in Lebanon, whether the inability to elect a president or lack of economic reforms, are all the result of a wave of subtle interference by the U.S.
The U.S. is pressurizing Lebanon economically to impose its conditions and bring to power a president who is loyal to Washington and is not friendly with the resistance, so that it can implement its policies by means of soft power. Having said that, it would not seem that the U.S. has launched a war on Lebanon or the resistance. While it would seem this is an internal Lebanese affair, this is where the threat lies in their plots.
Nasrallah also touched upon the issue of offshore oil and gas exploration, saying Hezbollah will hinder Israel's production of gas from oil fields should procrastination by the companies who have contracts with Lebanon continue.
After assassination of any prominent leader of Hezbollah, the resistance would go through a landmark transformation. Now, in light of what analysts see as a massive U.S. attempt to choke Lebanon politically and economically, the resistance progress is unhindered. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
a little crumbling space filled with dirt and garbage. Rohingya refugee camp on the outskirts of New Delhi is no more than an open prison for the members of the community who face constant threats and intimidation from law enforcement agencies. They say all their activities are being monitored and reported to the local police station on a daily basis. A member of the community is given that task, but that is not the only trouble.
My son was picked up by police along with his wife from outside our shanty 4 months ago. He did not commit any crime. He has been in a detention center for a long time now. I'm worried for him. The UN Refugee Agency says they are working on the case, but nothing has been done so far. He was working as a day laborer in nearby colonies. He did nothing wrong. I humbly urge for his release. We thank God that India gave us shelter, but there is constant fear of detention in the camp.
In recent weeks, the Delhi High Court ordered a joint inspection of the Rohingya Detention Center in New Delhi by officials of concerned agencies over the alleged lack of basic amenities. The court was hearing a plea of a female refugee who is facing bad health conditions due to the lack of basic facilities in the detention center.
My brother recently got married and he was detained just 3 days after his wedding along with his wife. Since then, he's in a detention center. My mother is blind and she cries every day for him. We have been living here for years and we are grateful to India for giving us refugees. I sell vegetables on the streets and similarly other men do menial work, but we are scared now since detention fear is looming across camps.
Most refugees here have heartbreaking tales of the past, and those memories of carnage and exodus are haunting them. Based on official estimates, India is home to some 40,000 Rohingya refugees, but independent reports put the figures at hundreds of thousands. Most of the refugees I spoke with feared that their identity would be disclosed, given the high risk of detention. Scores have also gone into hiding at undisclosed locations across India. They have a horrific tales of separation from their families amid a persistent deportation campaign and an intensified crackdown against the community. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Heads of NGOs in Syria have gathered to loudly voice an urgent need for help. In Damascus, more than 550 NGOs read out a statement before media outlets calling on the U.S. to lift its unilateral economic sanctions on Syria, explaining the years-long siege deprived Syria from its basic needs and equipment needed to rescue those affected by the deadly earthquake.
Today, I apologize to the victims who we heard their voices under the rubble but could not help. Our volunteers were hearing them but couldn't save them because we do not have necessary equipment. 12 years of sanctions left us without required vehicles and rescue equipment. Many people died under the rubble because of those sanctions.
Speakers say the recent ease of U.S. sanctions on Syria to help humanitarian aid reach the country is not effective. That's because banks, companies, and governments around the world are still reluctant to engage with Syria, as they might face legal obstacles in the future. Western states claim that food and medicine is not included in their list of sanctions, but the reality is vastly different.
Sanctions have affected my life, my neighbors, and all Syrian people. We don't have fuel or electricity, and this has raised prices of everything like food and medicine. This is unbearable, especially after the earthquake.
We all here came to say lift economic sanctions. This country cannot stand any more suffering. Even before the earthquake, we were collapsing economically. Those sanctions are only affecting the ordinary people, not the government.
Here, rescue workers are in a battle against time. The death toll keeps rising, and those who could get away from the earthquake are now struggling to survive with a lack of food and shelter. Syrians say it's about time the U.S. and its Western allies end the economic siege that has caused enormous pain and suffering for innocent citizens. They ask for a just and fair world where humanity comes first before all political agendas. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Thank you. Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown has had harsh criticism for corporate lobbyists and Norfolk Southern, the Atlanta-based operator of the train that derailed in East Palestine, Ohio, 2 weeks ago while carrying toxic chemicals. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The U.S. newspaper The Hill has covered this story and tells us more. Senator Sherrod Brown, Democrat of Ohio, on Sunday, 19th of February, said residents in East Palestine, Ohio, are right to be skeptical after a disastrous train derailment leaked toxic chemicals in the air, land, and water near their homes. Should the residents accept the assurances from the government, or are they right to be skeptical about these assurances? Anchor Pamela Brown asked the senator on CNN's State of the Union program. Well, they're right to be skeptical. The Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA administration, when I was there, both the state and federal EPA administrators said that. But when you return to your home, we think the water is safe. But when you return to your home, you should be tested again for your water and your soil and your air, the senator said. A 150-car train derailed in East Palestine, Ohio, earlier this month, sparking fires at the site of the pileup and causing chemicals to leak from one of several cars noted to be carrying hazardous materials, including the cancer-causing chemical vinyl chloride. Nearby residents were evacuated due to fears of possible explosion as officials conducted a controlled release to try and alleviate the danger. And though evacuation orders have since been lifted, toxic substances have leaked into nearby air and water, sparking environmental and health concerns. Would you drink the water in East Palestine? And do you think the officials there who are saying it's safe, they should drink the water too, to show the residents they would drink it? Pamela Brown asked the senator on Sunday. Senator Sherrod Brown replied, "Well, I think they are. I talked to the mayor. The mayor said definitely, emphatically, people can drink the water." This is really the same old story. Corporations do stock buybacks. They do big dividend checks. They lay off workers. Thousands of workers have been laid off from Norfolk Southern. Then they don't invest in safety rules and safety regulations, and this kind of thing happens, the senator added. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered this story and tells us more. The Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown had harsh criticism on Sunday, 19th of February, for corporate lobbyists in Norfolk Southern, the Atlanta-based operator of the train that derailed in East Palestine, Ohio, 2 weeks ago, while carrying toxic chemicals. Speaking on Sunday to CNN's State of the Union program, the Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown said the derailment, which released toxic chemicals, including The carcinogenic vinyl chloride was an episode of the same old story, and that Norfolk Southern caused it. Corporations do stock buybacks, they do big dividend checks, they lay off workers, Senator Brown said. Thousands of workers have been laid off from Norfolk Southern. Then they don't invest in safety rules and safety regulation, and this kind of thing happens. That's why people in East Palestine are so upset. They know that corporate lobbyists have had far too much influence in our government, and they see this as the result. These things are happening because these railroads are simply not investing the way they should in car safety and in the rail lines themselves. Senator Sherrod Brown said Norfolk Southern and corporate lobbyists were wholly responsible for the accident, which has caused breathing difficulties, rashes, nausea, headaches and swollen eyes, as well as killing pets and wildlife in the area. There's no question they caused it with this derailment because they underinvested in their employees. They never look out for their workers. They never look out for their communities. They look out for stock buybacks and dividends. Something's wrong with corporate America, and something's wrong with Congress and administration listening too much to corporate lobbyists. And that's got to change now. On Tuesday, Norfolk Southern pledged to distribute more than $1.2 million to nearly 900 families and a number of businesses affected by the crash, spill and the burn. A company spokesman said the financial assistance included direct payments of $1,000. Earlier this year, the company announced a $10 billion in stock buybacks. Last year, it reported $3.2 billion in profits. Senator Sherrod Brown warned residents along the Ohio and Pennsylvania border to be cautious. According to Senator Brown, the company made promises to him and the community, but he said if they write a check to an East Palestine or Unity Township resident or people even a little further away, never sign away your legal rights. You can accept a check, but don't sign anything that would sign away your legal rights. That's what companies like this do. He added that he was going to make sure that Norfolk Southern lives up to everything it needs to do. Senator Brown said he had urged Joe Biden and the U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg to strengthen regulations surrounding worker safety, consumer protection, and the environment. That's my job, to push the administration to move in Congress on more pro-consumer, pro-worker, pro-environment, and pro-community safety laws to make sure that these things don't happen, he said. Republicans, meanwhile, have criticized Pete Buttigieg's handling of the accident, arguing that the federal government has been too slow to respond. In a tweet on Wednesday, 15th of February, Buttigieg said the administration was restricted by certain laws on rail regulation. We're constrained by law on some areas of rail regulation, like the braking rule withdrawn by the Trump administration in 2018 because of a law passed by Congress in 2015. But we are using the powers that we do have to keep people safe, he said. That was a reference to an Obama-era rule that Trump administration repealed, which required trains carrying highly flammable crude oil be equipped with special brakes to halt all cars at the same time. Speaking to reporters, the Texas Senator Ted Cruz, the ranking member on the Senate Commerce, Science and Transportation Committee, said, I understand that the secretary is politically ambitious and he'd like to move to government housing in Washington right up the street, a reference to the White House, for which Pete Buttigieg ran in 2020, but he does have a job to do. Buttigieg, Senator Ted Cruz said, should focus on addressing the enormous challenges we have on our railways, with multiple derailments where the secretary has been absent without leave. The Ohio Senator J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio of Florida wrote to Pete Buttigieg demanding information from the U.S. Department of Transportation regarding its oversight of the United States freight train system, and more generally, how it balances building a safe, resilient rail industry across our country in relation to building a hyper-efficient one with minimal direct human input.
Sheikh Baqir Sharif Al-Qarashi decides to compile...
So we can consider Sayyid Hadi Khosrow Shahi...
Shaheed Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. He was born in Kadhimiyya.
The first and the most important thing that we can learn from Allama Tabatabai is his great effort.
In this regard, I should like to say that one of the great benefits of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mahmud Shahrudi was...
When we look at the works of late Rawzati...
There is a famous sentence from Mirza Khalil Qamarani that he says in Farsi, "Tuhid kalame baraye kalame tuhid."
Be more familiar with outstanding Shia figures in the teacher.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction into the thoughts and works of the most outstanding prominent Shiite scholars and thinkers all across the world. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Within the studio, I have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Om, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Shaykh Rouhani. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
And Shaykh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about one of the most outstanding fuqaha of the 10th century Hijra. He is no one but Zainuddin ibn Nuruddin Ali ibn Ahmad al-Amili al-Juba'i, mainly known as Shaheed al-Sani. He is known for his mastery over different jurisprudential schools of thought and also for his most outstanding book, which is an explanation on Shaheed al-Awwal's book, Al-Lummat al-Damashqiyya, Al-Rawzat al-Bahiyya, Fi Sharh al-Lummat al-Damashqiyya. Shaykh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. Give us some information about the early life of Shaheed al-Sani.
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Shaheed al-Thani actually was one of the fuqaha and the jurists of the Shayu in the 10th century, Hijri Qamari. He was the teacher and the professor of all the madhahib and the schools or the sects of Islam, the four main madhahib. And he was one of the scholars who taught these four madhahib for the people. I mean, you know, once you are just familiar with some of the schools, but sometimes you are a teacher. When you are a teacher teaching the followers of those religion, their doctrines, their teachings, it means that you are so much skillful, let's say professional in that field of studies. So that's why Shaheed al-Thani was not only knowing this madhahib, rather he was a teacher, a professor, yes, in those different fields of, let's say, religious studies. And of course, Shaheed al-Thani was born in the 13th of Shawwal, in 911 of Qamari, according to the Islamic calendar, in the village called Juba' in Lebanon. So, of course, the family of this Shaheed, the forefathers of this Shaheed, were among the scholars and Shuhada and the great figures of the Shayu in Lebanon.
Yes.
And he actually studied Islamic studies or fiqh and ahkam and Arabic literature and different kind of these Islamic lessons. He learned them in his house, first of all, in his family, because in his family there were some scholars. They taught him.
Yes.
And then he had actually trip and journey to many different cities to learn Islamic studies from Muhaqqiq Karaki.
Yes.
And from Sayyid Ja'fari Karaki and many other great scholars. And then he went to Damascus. To Damascus.
Damascus, that's right.
Yes, of course. There he became a very well-known and an outstanding scholar among the people. Later he became the teacher and the professor of all the different sects of Islam. So he was very much professional, skillful in all these fields of study, knowing ahadith, manabi, or the sources of ahkam of different madhahib.
Yes.
And of course, he traveled to Misr, to Hijaz, to And then for Ziyara to Beit al-Maqaddis, to Iraq, mm-hmm. to Constantine,
yes.
and many other areas and many other cities to learn, to spread the teachings of Islam and Ahl al-Bayt alayhim as-salatu was-salam. So, of course, he was one of the very great scholars yes. in the history.
One of the most important merits of Shahid al-Thani was his mastery over different jurisprudential schools of thought, or especially four or five schools of thought of Ahl Sunnah. Is it really difficult to have mastery over all of them? I mean, are there many differences between these schools of thought? We know that on that time, everything was from memory, okay? So answering different followers of different denominations according to their schools of thought might be a difficult task, isn't it, Sayyid?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, obviously, there are not much differences mm-hmm. in the rulings, we can say. We have a lot of similarities amongst the rulings that we have. But the methodology is maybe different. The way of performing something, for example, you know, in Ahl Sunnah, they have to close their arms to pray.
Okay.
Now, some close their arms on the stomach or tummy. Yes. Some bring it on the chest, some yes. under the chest. So there are the slight differences,
yes.
and there are some more other things. So, but the main point is learning all these things, spending time to know the difference of the different schools, and when someone is coming and answering them, yes, it was an extraordinary thing to do. And since he used to teach all the scholars from all the schools. When we say five schools, it means the Shia school, Imamiyah,
yes.
and the four Sunni school. And sometimes the Ahl Sunnah used to know him as a Sunni scholar, you know, the way he used to teach the things to them. It was because he was one of the extraordinary personalities. He was from the family, the scholar family, the way it was said, is from the Silsilatul Dhahab.
Uh-huh.
You know, the golden chain.
Yes, yes.
The golden chain means that his forefathers, whoever you look, they were the scholars. And even in his descendants, that the Shahid Sadr, Shahid Baghr al-Sadr, yes. or Shahid Hassan, you know, we have
Hassan
the Hassan al-Sadr.
Yes.
They're also said that they were from his descendants.
Oh.
So, and obviously when such a personality who was brought up in the scholarly environment, obviously, he should be lookalike Shahid al-Thani uh-huh. because, you know, it is the requirement of someone
yes,
who
yes.
is in the environment of the scholarly environment, we can say.
Okay.
They should have this. And on the other hand, you know, the reason of his Shahada, like his martyrdom, because
yes,
he's
yes.
known as the second Shahid.
Yes.
First of all, like if we talk about the father of Shahid Bahai, Sheikh Bahai.
Sheikh Bahai, yes.
He said that once I met Shahid al-Thani, while he was alive, and he said that I think that I will be the second martyr amongst the scholars.
Okay.
And he said why? He said that I have seen in the
dreams yes.
that I went to one of the, you know, the invitations or dinner, and there everyone was there, and it was the dinner by Murtaza Alam al Huda. And then when I went there, I saw that Sayyid Murtaza.
Sharif al-Murtaza.
Yes, yes. He stood up, he welcomed me, and uh-huh. he asked me to sit next to Shahid Awwal, the
oh.
first martyr, the Shahid Awwal.
So this was a sign
so
that...
This was a sign for me.
For me.
And later we have seen that how he was martyred. Basically, he was at the Mecca where, you know, the prime minister of the time of the Osmanic emperorship,
yes.
Some people came to him and they said, like, Shahid Thani, he is basically, he's propagating the Shia
mm-hmm.
school of thought. He teaches to the Shia ulama.
Yes.
And therefore, he sent some people to arrest him. And when they arrest him, without asking him the reason, without taking him to the king of the time, they just killed him.
Mm-hmm.
And he got martyred because of preaching the Imamiyah, fiqh or jurisprudence.
That's right. His books are so many, according to Sayyid Mohsen al-Amin. More than 79 books have been authored by this outstanding man. And nowadays, you know, all these books are collected in Musu'a. You know, the collection of the books on Musu'a to Shahid al-Thani is really magnum opus. Now, some of the outstanding books, we can say Masalik al-Afham, Fi Shar al-Shara'i al-Islam, we can say Ar-Rawzat al-Bahiyya, Fi Shar al-Rumat al-Lamashqiyya. We'll get to this book. Muniat al-Murifi, Adab al-Mufid wal-Mustafid, and so many other outstanding book regarding Shahida Sani.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah.
La ilaha illallah.
But most of the people and most of the Hausa students nowadays know him by Rozat al-Bahiyya. What is this book, Shaykh Rouhani?
Yes, one of the very well-known and famous works of Shahid al-Thani, as you rightly mentioned, is this Rozat al-Bahiyya fi Sharh al-Lum'at al-Dimishqiyya.
Yes.
Of course, this book is like a commentary on the book written by Shahid al-Awwal, al-Lum'a. So this book was also welcomed very much by the students, by the ulama, by the scholars in the history. And yes, of course, this Rozat al-Bahiyya is a book in which again he, like Shahid al-Awwal, categorized and classified the ahadith and the narrations and the ahkam of Islam into different categories by according to these main topics and subjects. He actually issued his fatwa and ahkam on Shiite kind of rulings, according to the Shiite rulings and jurisprudential, let's say, rulings. So, yes, he got familiar with this book when he was young, because in his childhood, actually, he learned this book. Someone taught him the book Al-Lum'at al-Dimashqiyya. Then later, it was one of his main objective to write a commentary, an explanation on this book. Of course, that's why this book became like a main source of Shiite jurisprudence for the scholars, not only the scholars, but also the students. And of course, he added some two main babs into that book, because Shahid al-Awwal's book was of 50 bab, or let's say 50 entries, we can say. But his book is like 52 entries in ahkam or in fiqh. And yes, this were all about the book. Of course, as you see, the structure of this book is like this, that he start with the book Tahara, Salat, Zakat, Khums, Saum. And then finally he end to Diyat and Qisas.
Okay.
So, of course, these are the main parts of this book. But a lot of scholars in the history, they actually wrote their own commentaries and explanations
on this book.
You know, whenever the scholars write commentaries on a book, it means that that book is very much important.
That's right.
Like, for example, Sahib al-Jawahir, he wrote a book, but later you see lots of people wrote many other books.
Or Urwatul Wuthqa.
Kifayatul
Usul.
Exactly. Urwatul Wuthqa, if you refer nowadays to the commentaries of Urwatul Wuthqa, they are available on the internet as well.
Yes.
And it you see that how much important was this book, that even nowadays in modern fuqaha, still they are trying to write their commentaries on that book. But one of the other very, very nice book and very, very useful book, not only for the students, but also for even normal people, for the youth, is that Munyatul Murid. If they study Munyatul Murid, in Munyatul Murid, Shahid al-Thani, rahmatullahi alayh, collected very nice, very practical, adaptable kind of instructions for all the people, how to live, you know, in terms of morality, in terms of ethical kind of issues, how to train themselves to be good people.
A practical,
book. It is very nice. It is very helpful. And it is also, the text is very simple. It's not that much difficult, that much complicated. The students of Hausa, the students of Islamic Seminary, have to read this book. But of course, even for the rest of the people, it is very much useful, Munyatul Murid.
That's all right. Another akhlaqi book is Kashf al-Ghaiba and Ahkam al-Ghaiba. This is also an outstanding book. This is, we can say, an outstanding. Most of his books are really outstanding. What about Rozat al-Bahiyya? Do you have anything to say, Sayyid Mufsir, about this book?
Well, obviously, we know that Shahid al-Awwal, when he wrote the book, it was for the government officials or the kings or ministers, and it was too short. Like, he didn't bring any explanation about that. And as it is rightly mentioned, that Shahid Thani, when he came up, he tried to bring more explanation about that. Mm-hmm. And the major reason of being popular amongst the, we can say, Islamic seminary, this book being more famous than the actual book.
Yes.
Like, the commentary is more famous than the actual book, which was written by Shahid Awwal.
Even sometimes they are misunderstood because, say, Al-Lummatul Damashqiyya, they study the book of Shahid Thani instead of Shahid Awwal.
Shahid Awwal.
Okay.
So mostly it is the second book, which is the commentary of this, which is written by Shahid Thani. It's because he brought more details over there. Mm-hmm. He came with the commentary, the proofs, and the major thing is because this book has more... they call it furu'at, subtopics.
Subtopics, sub-branches.
We have one major topic, for example, tahara. Under the tahara or the purification, we have subtopics as well. So he had added those things, and it is full of that. And there are many other things which were added in under the main topics, because Shahid Awwal, when he wrote it, he just wrote the major things, and he didn't went towards the details of that. That's why a person who wants to become a jurist... in today's world, he has to study this book first, and after that, we move on towards the other books at the the higher level or the kharij. So basically, it is good to know. And the main thing is that it covers all the areas of the life. For example, it has ibadat, which is worshipping.
Yes,
like prayer, fasting, doing hajj, homes. On the other hand, it has the second portion, which is mu'amilat, where how to deal.
Yes.
The contracts.
Transactions.
Yes. Contract. And then we have ahkam and uqood as well. Mm-hmm. Like the contracts as in like the marriage contract, for example. Okay. All those things. And the ahkam as well. There are some hukm as well.
Yes.
And especially like about the matter of inheritance, the matter of, retribution and all those things. So all these things are covered in this book. And that's why it is much more popular and famous. And generally, in 2 years, 2 to 3 years time, the Islamic seminary students, they finish the book, if they read it in detail, if they want to finish the whole book. And the prerequisite of these books are the Arabic grammar. You cannot read these books without knowing the Arabic, because it is a scholarly, pure scholarly, we can say, like, language has been used, which cannot be merely translated or understood by a general Arabic language.
Thank you very much, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration on the life account of Shahid Thani. He was martyred on Rabiul Awwal 965 at the age of 54. His burial place is not known, because it is believed that his body was taken into the sea and drowned into the sea, unfortunately. Again, we can say the animosity of the Ahlul Bayt and the Imamiyya on that time was the main cause for the martyrdom of Shahid Thani by the kings of the time. May Allah bless the soul of Shahid Thani, the author of Rozatul Bahiyya and Munyatul Murifi, Adab al Mufid wal Mustafid. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program. The teacher, for more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Till another episode, God bless you. Fi amanullah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.